Sam there looking at the times when City goalkeepers...
Oh, David, sorry, the doorbell's just rang. One sec, sorry.
Was it your Nespresso pods by any chance?
It was, yes. I don't know what the free gift is. Do you want to do a live unboxing or do we have time?
Let's find out.
Right, okay. So the context being that they had an offer on to order your pods, which I needed anyway, and get a free gift, and I don't know what the free gift is going to be. I did say to David earlier that it would probably be a mug or some such. There is a lovely cardboard box here. Inside the bigger cardboard box, let's give that a quick open.
That's a parcel, isn't it now?
I opened another cardboard box.
Wrapped inside some kind of lovely paperwork, and it doesn't feel like a mug. What on earth is this? It's a lovely metal, of almost zero use to me. It's a chocolate shaker
like a
cappuccino. That's very kind of them. Maybe I'll start to use it.
Just you don't have to use it on cappuccino. You could just shake chocolate onto other things.
Directly into my mouth.
Yeah.
all right.
Excellent. Let's crack on.
This is Blue Moon. It's the original fan-made Manchester City podcast. Coming up, we've got news and views from City's week. It's your club, and this is your show.
Oh, how a good start to the season can suddenly leave you in a bit of a grump. Back-to-back Premier League defeats for Manchester City for the first time in 5 years, and an international break to follow has left us all stewing on the rather unfortunate loss at the Emirates. Pep Guardiola's side may only be 2 points off the top of the table, but the fixture list when domestic action returns looks a little unsavoury. Still, that's a can we're going to kick down the road for another week anyway. Welcome to this week's Blue Moon podcast, where we've had time to digest what happened at Arsenal last Sunday, so expect some level-headed and measured reaction. Hopefully. We'll find out shortly what this week's guests thought of that performance. Also on today's show, we're on a whistle-stop tour of some things that we don't often get time to discuss, thanks to that international break. There is a reason, however tenuous it may be, but we're going to be looking at goalkeepers who have found themselves outfield and outfielders who have found themselves in goal. And with the UK and Ireland being awarded Euro 2028, we're going to take a look at the international matches played at the Etihad Stadium. Before we get to that, though, let's talk about Arsenal. I'm David Mooney. With me this week, I've got two City fans in the shape of Sam Roscoe.
Hello, mate.
And Richard Burns.
Hello there.
Hello. Sam, welcome to the show for the first time this season. Sorry, again, I seem to have picked a week where City have lost.
Yeah, that's in my contract, isn't it, with the podcast? I only come on after defeats these days. Although, we made this exact same joke last time and it was off the back of a good win, I recall. So, nice to see that the ratio is positively in favour for the negative chat when it comes to City. So, That's what I'm all about.
Exception that proves the rule. Last one, I think, was the case. Richard, you
anomaly.
Yeah.
Yes. Thank you. Yeah. Are you?
Yeah. You seem taken aback by the fact that I might ask you how you are.
I was still trying to work out positively in favour of negative ratio, and just thinking of like what the opposite of that is, so I could make some kind of humorous intro, and I can't do it in my head.
Well, would
so
that not be negatively in favour of positive ratio?
Well, if you can, you be negatively in favour?
Oh, that's a good question.
Against. We're straight in with the tricky questions, aren't we?
Yeah, you can definitely be positively against, but can you be negatively for? I don't know. Yeah, you must be able to. I don't know.
Answers on a postcard.
The upshot of all this is that I'm very well.
Excellent. Right. Well, we've put it off no more. Let's talk about the Arsenal game. For the 2023-24 season, the Blue Moon podcast is sponsored by Green King Sports, where football is more than a game. Green King Sports venues are showing every televised Manchester City fixture over the 23-24 season. So instead of turning to the internet for a dodgy stream, get your mates together and get down to your local Green King pub and get closer to the action. Green King Sports have recently launched the Green King Sports Instagram page, which will be a home to fans. Content, deals and competitions throughout the season. Drop them a follow and you won't just be the first to know about all of this. You'll also be helping out the Blue Moon podcast as well. Arsenal then, Richard. I've seen people suggesting that Guardiola was a little bit too cautious in the way he approached this one. Obviously no Rodri in the team, wasn't available. And you can understand why Guardiola might look at that and go, you know what, I'm going to be quite cautious here. Do you agree that he was overly cautious though?
No, I don't think I do, because City, there's a context to it, isn't there, where despite having very good results against Arsenal, like, you know, over the last, was it six seasons? Was it 12 victories, 12 league victories in a row
against
them?
2015 it was, yeah.
Yeah, like, so that's obviously a very good record, but it it doesn't tell the full story, does it? City were not fantastic at the Emirates last year. They weren't overwhelmingly the better team, despite a 3-1 win.
They didn't control the game, maybe.
Yeah, and the year before, I mean, Arsenal were the better team in that game, I think, and City were fortunate to walk away with a 2-1 stoppage time win, and obviously you take them all and make your own look, blah, 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 but City were not the better team in that game. And I think taking a cautious approach reflects the respect that Pep has for Arsenal and the respect for that challenge, and probably the acknowledgement that, this is going to sound daft, like with the knowledge of the result, but probably reflects the acknowledgement that you can't keep going there and not being the better team and expect to come away with a positive result. And obviously it so happens that we came away with a negative result anyway. But I think you're sort of backfilling the narrative then to say that that was the wrong approach. I think it makes a lot of sense. And as I'm sure we'll touch on, it's a big slice of luck that means that that City have walked away with no points from that game.
Yeah.
I'm quite, you know, I mean, obviously we'd all love to see swashbuckling attacking football against any and every opponent, but I think it's like one of the reasons City was so successful last season was because Pep has over time tailored his approach to suit the circumstances, and Sunday was just an example of that, where the result doesn't quite work out, but I don't think the performance demonstrates that it was the wrong approach.
Yeah, I mean, obviously, Sam, no Rodri is huge. We'll talk a bit about him a little bit later in the show. You can kind of understand Guardiola just going, you know what, let's shut this game down at the moment. Because, like, as Richard said, the number of times that Arsenal have just ran through City in the last few years, but City have been able to just deal with it and get the result. If you haven't got the main man there who deals with that sort of things, you can understand him being a bit cagey, can't you?
Yeah, I suppose so. I don't think it was necessarily cagey. I actually think when you look at the tactics, and in particular that first 20 minutes, you can see what he was doing with the lineup. So I've seen, you know, a lot of fans and a lot of friends that don't necessarily watch Manchester City week in, week out, or don't watch Bernardo Silva that often, comment about why on earth was he playing Bernardo Silva in a holding midfield role? Well, you know, yes, on paper, when you've got Bernardo Silva in the middle of midfield, I suppose technically it is a holding midfielder's role, but he wasn't playing a holding midfielder's role. He was playing that sort of quarterback role of trying to dominate the tempo of the game, which is exactly what happened for City in that first half. It was clear that the tactics were dominate the ball, kill any sort of atmosphere that, you know, that was around the Emirates Stadium, and get on the score sheet. And they were close on a couple of occasions in that first 20 minutes, but in terms of dominating the play, dominating the tempo, that's exactly what they did. Arsenal just sort of stepped it up after that and sort of broke down City's passing game. And then that's where the game sort of went a little bit flat from a City perspective. They never really got back into that that momentum of keeping the ball and nullifying any sort of any crest of a wave that Arsenal had built up around the atmosphere, etc. So that was the first thing for me. You know, Bernardo Silva's role was very much to, yes, be in that middle, be industrial and recycle the ball as much as possible. He wasn't playing a holding midfielder's role,
yeah,
in that sense that he's going to defend and sweep up, etc.
Yeah, can I just ask you, Sam, because I don't watch American football, what the hell does a quarterback do?
They get the ball and they make all the plays.
Right, okay, that makes more sense, because I've never watched it and I don't really understand it. So I've heard a few people say, oh, the quarterback role and apply it to football, and I'm just like, yeah, no, I just nod along sagely and like not really understand what's going on.
They're the main player in terms of offensive game. So in the sense that Bernardo Silva against Arsenal was in the middle of the pitch where a quarterback would be, all the sort of play was building up through him, was going through him, etc.
Right.
And that's where I sort of, you know, compare him to a quarterback in American football, in the sense that he was the main man on the pitch from an offensive position that was making sure the ball was going to the right place, etc.
Yeah, who's your NFL team? Do you have one?
I don't really have one. I have a few soft spots for a few teams because I I've seen a couple of games at Wembley and I've followed a couple of teams there, but it's really interesting this year, actually. There's a few teams that aren't performing as well as expected, mainly the Bengals. Their centre-back, Joe Burrow, who was the hottest property in NFL last season, really young player, just signed a big contract, isn't living up to expectations so far this season. But on the opposite side of things, Patrick Mahomes at the Chiefs is killing it. So.
Yeah.
Podcast am I on?
I was thinking that, yeah.
And that is the limit of my NFL knowledge, everybody. Don't try and get me on an NFL podcast. That's about it.
The furthest mine goes is I know that Mo covers his... I can't remember if it's when he covers his mouth with the glass to say what his team is. I can't remember whether it's the Atlanta Falcons or... the Denver Broncos, but Mo's certainly embarrassed about the team that he supports, and that's all I know from The Simpsons. But there we go. Let's let Richard. I'm not going to inflict any more NFL on you because I don't. I assume, like me, you watch football and nothing else.
Correct.
Yeah. So let's carry on with the Arsenal chat. Guardiola ultimately said he wanted more players in the middle of the pitch. It's a weird question given that City have lost, but did you feel that City were much more in control of this game than they had been in previous years, and that was a positive?
Yeah, I think so. I think, obviously, there were the early chances for City where, you know, there's a chance that falls to Aki very early in the game, and, you know, the sort of last player, I think it was you who said actually in our WhatsApp chat, David, that he's like the last player on the pitch that you probably want in that position. Anybody else, it's probably a goal.
Someone suggested Diaz, and I was like, actually, yeah, that's fair enough.
Fair point. Yeah, that's fair. But if I, you know, if that goes in, then obviously things feel very different. But as it didn't, and as the game went on, yeah, I think it felt reasonably in control. I didn't feel, certainly early on, like a major risk.
Well, here's the thing, though. It's like early on, like Sam said, City were the more offensive in the early stages. By the end of the game, less so. And is it ultimately a case of, if you know that you're going to have a tight game, if you know that you're going to make this a really tight game, when you have the chance to create a chance, you've got to create something, and City weren't really doing that?
I think that's true, and I think I'm grateful for you saying that, because I think it's a better way of wording what I was about to say anyway, that basically as the game went on, the less I felt like City were going to score, and the more that then made me feel at risk, because the more sort of Arsenal, although it wasn't like, you know, chance after chance or...
No,
like
battering on any doors, was there? No.
Yeah, having to do like emergency defending, there was just like... I just had this feeling of like, this is Arsenal's to grasp now. There isn't really the incentive for City to take any more risks than they are doing. They're away from home against a title rival. There is no reason for them to, you know, if they're not battering the door down now, then they're going to try and hold what they have. Whereas for Arsenal, there is every reason to, although, you know, I'm sure they wouldn't have been too disappointed with a draw at this stage in the season themselves. But that incentive of being able to feel like they're making a statement, even if as City fans, it probably doesn't feel like we're suddenly under any more pressure than we already were, because we know that you can lose games early in the season and still recover that and blah, blah, blah. But for Arsenal, it is what you would see as a statement win. And so everything was there for them to keep pushing. And I definitely felt the more it went on, even if it wasn't necessarily based on the game, just sometimes that sort of horrible gut feeling you get. I remember thinking like, we're really pushing into territory here where Arsenal, if they create a chance and nick it, then we're not going to get this back. And that was more the feeling than like than ever worrying that it was out of control in any way.
Yeah. Sam, can I ask you, do you feel that it was a bit of a statement win for Arsenal? Because I would always counter that by saying both teams were very happy to play out the draw, and Arsenal won it by smashing a ball into Nathan Ake's face. It's like you have won it by fluke here.
I think it turned into a statement win because the news agenda around the build-up of the game, obviously City have dominated at Arsenal for so long. Obviously, Peter Drury nodded to that. They cracked the City code, if you like, even though it was off Ake's face. It was a deflected goal. But then that being said, look, I think the biggest statement from an Arsenal perspective in that game was Arteta made very positive changes. He brought on the likes of Kai Havertz. He brought on Gabriel Martinelli, who went on to have the impact that he did. He did look really, really good when he came on as well, Martinelli, and ultimately he did make that difference. So I think they can class it as a statement win because of the record between the two teams going into it, the nature of the game in terms of first and second in the Premier League last season, the way things are going, it's looking as though both sides are going to be challenging for the title again. And I think, yeah, they got one over on City.
Did you get any sense from Arsenal, though, that you didn't already have? Do you know what I mean? Like we know that City will be there or thereabouts at the end of the season. Did you get anything from Arsenal's performance that suggested that they'd grown from last season? Because ultimately, I mean, the reason I asked that is because my feeling at full time was I felt more threatened by Arsenal last season. And I it just felt like they allowed City to control more of the game and then won it on a piece of good fortune.
I think the opposite for me, to be honest. I think the fact that this game was dull as dishwater, but Arsenal got something out of it. They got what they needed to get out of it. That's, I hate how cliche it is, but if you want to be at the top of the title, you know, the top of the title race, you want to win the title race, you want to be top of the table come May, these are the moments and these are the games where you have to make things happen for you. And making those positive changes that Arteta did, the impact that Martinelli had on what was a dull game that was destined to be a draw at, 80 minutes or whatever, then that was more of a, oh, actually, look, these are learning, these are growing up now, this Arsenal side, and they're not just going to, you know, be pushovers, if you like, and they are developing that winning mentality, which, look, you know, in their position that they're in at the minute, we have to go back to the 2010 to remember what it was like when we were almost there. You know, we were almost there, weren't we, in the Premier League title race? We were almost there in the Champions League. We were almost there in the FA Cup, etc. And it's these little moments that can really tweak a side's mentality. Yes, it wasn't an amazing game. Doesn't matter. All that matters at the end of the day is they got the 3 points. They won the game 1-0. It was the worst game to watch, but they, you know, those Arsenal fans in that stadium don't care. They got the win. So for me, the sort of worry after the match is that we've seen Arsenal do what they needed to do. And in the past, I feel like that Arsenal would have settled for a draw, but they made the positive changes. They got what they needed to do at all costs. And that was win. That was get 3 points. And I'm sure if you listen to an Arsenal podcast and they're reviewing the game, they're not going to care about the performance. It wasn't entertaining. It wasn't the blockbuster that we were all anticipating. The biggest thing for them is that they got the 3 points at the end of the game, and they were the side that was celebrating after 90 minutes.
Yeah, I think they had settled for the draw, though, and got lucky. But, you know, that's just me. Richard, there's the other side of this is I do want to talk about Kovacic slightly, but I kind of want to frame it in the sense of, did you get the impression early in the game that the crowd was edgy and the stadium was really edgy because David Raya had been put under pressure a couple of times with certainly with Julian Alvarez, but maybe a couple of other players as well? And I remember thinking at that time, City really need to capitalise on this. And then in making the challenge that Kovacic makes, suddenly everybody is united in the stadium in hating Kovacic instead of worrying about Raya. Do you know what I mean?
That's a very interesting way to frame it, because I thought you were going to frame it as, is he an idiot?
Well, I mean, he's clearly an idiot. We don't need to go over that.
Yeah. I mean, get moments like that, there's almost like a, as a football fan, sometimes, whether you acknowledge it or not, sometimes you want to feel like an injustice has gone against you. And because that's one of the things that gets an atmosphere up most, isn't it? Like, if you think that somebody should have been sent off and they've not been, then it suddenly stops just being you against the opponent. And it's you against the world. And it's proper, like, it really contributes to that siege mentality stuff. And like Pep has used that like more and more for City in recent years, in particular last season. Like, how many times do you hear him say, something on the lines of, we did this all ourselves, nobody gave us anything.
Yeah.
And he'll always drop that line in, as much as he might not directly criticise referees very often. He will often say along the lines of, nobody gave us anything, we know what, you know, we know what we've been given, we know what, we've not had help, that kind of thing. And so it's very easy to imagine that that Arsenal would use a similar thing, and whether that be the players or the atmosphere or whatever, like, as a fan, if you see something that, I mean, that, especially after a VAR review, how that first challenge is not a red card is absolutely beyond me. It's terrible refereeing. It's a stupid tackle. And then to go out so soon after and make another absolutely stupid challenge when already on a yellow card, I'd be, if I'm at the Etihad and something like that goes against City, I'd be absolutely fuming. And that'd be, I mean, that'd almost get as much a reaction as a goal. Obviously with very negative emotions, but you'd be losing it at the referee, wouldn't you? So, and like you say, you'd have the opposition player to boo and to be annoyed at for the rest of the game. So yeah, I can absolutely see that that would sort of shift the atmosphere in the stadium and change it from cagey and all that, you know, sort of everything that you alluded to being a bit of a momentum shift. And Arsenal, I think, utilise the crowd very well, to be fair. Arteta's always G'ing them up, and it's a new thing with Arsenal.
He didn't need an excuse, did he, Arteta?
Yeah, exactly. It's always, he's always on the edge, isn't he? He's always...
That was a frustrating thing for me, because I mentioned earlier, it was clear that the game plan in the first 20 minutes was to nullify, you know, that atmosphere that the fans at Arsenal can generate these days, to be fair to him. And then they start to do that, but then Kovacic just gives them the biggest excuse to all get up out of their seats again, you know?
If you could sit down with him, Sam, at full time in that game, put your arm around him and give him a little bit of a team talk, what would you say to him?
Don't fucking do that again.
Yeah, I wondered if you'd pick a few more choicer words. I mean, ultimately, the first challenge notwithstanding, because he could have gone for that one. In the end, it's one of them. I actually think it's one of them where, you know, the referee gives a yellow card, the VAR is probably right not to overturn it. But if he gives a red card, the VAR is again probably not right to. VAR would probably not overturn it either. It's one of them where, like, ultimately you can make a case for it being one or the other. So I'm not that obviously as a City fan, I'm not that unhappy that he wasn't sent off. But like Richard said, Sam, like, why do you go diving into a challenge 10 minutes later?
Yeah, I honestly don't know what the answer is, to be honest with you. And imagine if City would have won the game or it would have been a draw. That's exactly what would have dominated for the coming weeks and days, that Kovacic should have been sent off, because he should have been sent off. Absolutely.
Mate, there's already loads of people who already think there's a massive refereeing conspiracy in favour of City. It's like City have lost the last two games. Like, what are you trying to spin here?
Well, I mean, to be fair, the referees have tried to help us out in some way, but it's not quite the case against Arsenal.
Yeah, I mean, and the Wolves one, the winning goal was scored by a man who also should have been sent off. So it's like, it's, you know, maybe use some bigger picture thinking here.
You see stats pop up all the time about clubs and players, and you want to know that exact thing about City. There's an answer, statcity.co.uk. Want to find out all of the players who played alongside club legends like David Silva, Sergio Aguero or Vincent Kompany? Or maybe you'd like to know which team found it hardest to score past Joe Hart. You can find out City's record in every competition, at every stadium, and under every manager. Just go to statcity.co.uk and browse away. That's statcity.co.uk. You can listen to the show ad-free by joining our Patreon, patreon.com/Blue Moon Podcast.
Obviously, Kovacic in the centre of the pitch, one of the players replacing the Rodri role. Richard, it's three games without Rodri, two of them meaningful, one of them a little less so, because Rodri wouldn't have played in that anyway. No wins, though. Are you a bit concerned by that?
Yeah, is the short answer. I think we know how important Rodri is to City. I think he's become like so sort of important in his position that it genuinely feels when he's at his absolute imperious best, it is truly like playing with an extra player. Like he seems to be in more places than one person should be. His reading of the game is extraordinary. His physicality, his ability to then get play moving again, the fact that when he's won the ball back, the way that he can get the team back on the front foot, the fact that he's becoming more reliable than most defensive midfielders are for a goal. Like that's a huge, huge thing to take out of the team, that screening of the defence and like I say, starting the play again as well. And to take that out of the team, it's not reasonable to think that you could replace that with one player, because that's what you get with the best players in the world. In the same way that you can't replace, maybe this isn't the best time to say this, but in general, you can't replace Haaland's goals with one player. You can't put an equivalent goal scorer in his position and expect the same return. And it's the same with Rodri. He's arguably the best midfielder in the world. I think he's definitely the best central defensive midfielder in the world. And he is, I think, City's most important player because of what he offers, because of the difference that he makes to the team. And so I think you can always you can break down anything and say, well, the Arsenal goal was deflected. They've sort of hit a long ball to start that move. Would it have been different if Rodri played? Maybe not. Would the Wolves goals have been scored if Rodri was playing? Maybe. But we'll never know. And I think as a straight up, do you think City would have lost three domestic games in a row if Rodri was playing them? I think it's quite hard to imagine that they would have done. Mm. Even you take the Newcastle game, and maybe he wouldn't have started anyway, because like you say, it's the least important game. Maybe the least important game we'll play all season. The way the momentum shifted in the second half of that game, you think a player of Rodri's ability and experience would have a better go at wrestling some of that back than having Calvin Phillips there. Or while Kovacic and Nunez are, for as good as they are, still getting used to playing for City, how could you reasonably expect them to do Rodri's job? Like, you just couldn't, because that's what you get with the best players in the world. Other people can't do their job. So it worries me, but only in the sense of, like, you expect to drop off when you take your best players out. And it's annoying that it was his own stupidity that meant he was out for those games.
I was going to say, Sam, if you could stick your arm around him and have that team talk at the end of the Forest game, what would you say to him?
I'd say, you just keep doing what you're doing, because you are mustard. No, in all seriousness, the thing that has been evident to me in the games where he has been absent, it's obvious now, we're missing his arrogance. That's what's been missing in those games. He knows how good he is. He knows that he's a game changer. He knows that he is the best player on the pitch, and he knows that he can get... And that rubs off on the team around him. You know, the confidence that those players must have, seeing that they've got Rodri alongside them to sweep things up and to recycle the ball and to be that third man running into the box, is a huge miss. Richard made some really good points there on everything that he brings to City. But the one thing for me that he didn't mention that is absolutely key is that confidence and that arrogance. Mm-hmm. I think that's a reason why he probably got sent off as well against Wolves. Against Forest, because he probably fell into the trap that a player was having a go at him and was getting stuck into him, really, when that's not something he's used to because of the level that he's at the minute.
Let me throw you a little curveball to a Rodri-less City, Sam, and suggest that actually maybe the problem isn't that there's nobody screening the defence and nobody holding the centre of midfield like he does, but actually that there's nobody higher up the pitch, like Gundogan, for instance, who can keep the ball in tight areas.
Yeah, 100%. I think that's another one that has been pretty clear in the last sort of few games that they've lost, is that he had a big impact, not just with his goals in key moments, but also, you know, it sounds really, really stupid, but you can't lose a game if the ball's not in your half. And like you say, was great at being available, being a constant sort of presence to offload the ball up the field, if you like. He held on to it really well and created as well. That's one thing that, you know, obviously we talked about it in the Arsenal game, but they're all very similar, the defeats. They've not really created that much. They've struggled breaking sides down, and I think that's where we probably undersold Gundogan's importance in the City team in terms of that creative output and bringing other players into the game. Yeah. So, yeah.
Now, Richard, I'm going to give you an absolute hospital pass it. So sorry about this. But in terms of a setup and creativity and control, and knowing that Guardiola wanted to go to the Emirates and just dominate possession and maybe keep it really tight, maybe not create too much and make sure that Arsenal don't create much. If that was the case, and he knows that he's going to provide very, very little service for Haaland, is there a case for dropping him and playing a false nine instead when you haven't got Rodri?
Well, I mean, I don't think it's a hospital pass of a question in the sense that I think it's a really good question. And
because the answer is obviously no, you can't drop Erling Haaland. That's the answer.
Like, I think that's, if you've got him, that's the only position that you can, like, I think that's the only logical conclusion you can come to. For all the arguments that I think, yes, playing with a false nine, great in theory. Obviously, City have made that work extremely well in the past when they've barely had a recognised striker. But they have got Haaland, and he does average somewhere around a goal a game.
If you can't get the ball to him, though.
Yeah, but I think it's always, like, the game plan isn't, for as much as the game plan might not be gung-ho or super offensive, the game plan isn't specifically don't get the ball to Haaland, is it? The setup might make it harder.
It'd be wild if it was.
No, but you know, but like, that's relevant though, isn't it?
Yeah,
like,
it's definitely,
it sounds like they're not playing to not get him into the game. They're playing with the knowledge that he brings, a very certain skill set, which really is striking and scoring goals. And the rest of his game is very much still in development. And there are some really good examples. I mean, Ironically, one of the best examples of his link-up play has been against Arsenal.
Yeah, I don't think that's ironic.
That home game last year.
I'm struggling with the irony here.
Yeah, it's probably not, but I've just thrown it out there now. Alanis Morissette made a career off doing that. I'm fine with it. His game is still in development. And so, you know, like, part of what you accept putting him in is we are not playing in a way today that is likely to create a whole lot of chances. But the flip side is that an on-form Haaland doesn't need many chances, does he? He doesn't need many touches. Like, if the ball comes to him in the box, one touch will often result in a goal. And again, he's not at the height of that at the moment. He looks a bit of a shell of himself, really. Like, he doesn't look confident. I think he's carrying himself a little bit differently on the pitch. But none of that changes the fact that he has the ability to score a goal with one touch, however the ball might fall to him in the box. So, and you know, those goals are going to come back because he's just too good for them not to. Yeah. And so the risk of taking him out is you deny yourself that opportunity to score early or score late, or, you know, but however that comes, goals are the currency, aren't they? Goals are the currency of football, and he's the most likely to bag you one.
His exchange rate is really good. I don't know if that works.
Ironically, it
probably doesn't.
yeah.
Sam,
play him is what I'm saying. David.
Yeah, I get it. Sam, the interesting thing about Haaland is, as Richard said, like, he's at a level with his ability to score that even Aguero wasn't at, because Guardiola would look at City's team sometimes and go, you know what, I'm not playing Sergio Aguero today for tactical reasons. And he looks at City's squad currently and goes, I have to do whatever I can to get Haaland into the team and make sure that he's there and is an option. And it kind of suggests, like, maybe one of the reasons that he's not been firing in the last few weeks is that City are just working through some things. They're working out how to try and how to approach this season with their new setup.
I think as well, other teams are fully aware of Erling Haaland's capabilities. They've had a full season, haven't they, to see where he likes to move, you know, how he likes to receive the ball, where he likes to run onto to get the ball, and how City play to him. So I think that's something that can't be discredited in terms of how other teams are playing against City, and in particular against Erling Haaland. I think that's something that is down to City now to go, right, well, I'm reluctant to use this phrase, which means I'm going to say it anyway.
I say you don't have to do it. You could, there's plenty of other words.
No, I'll say it and you'll understand what I mean. Like, I don't want to say that Haaland's been found out, because he hasn't, clearly. He's a freak. And he can score at any moment, sort of thing. But teams are getting to know how to effectively play against him better than last season. I think that's probably where we're at with it. Like we saw, for example, Arsenal, Rice was pretty much everywhere. And then Saliba and Gabriel, who were very much formed like a triangle, if you like, in that midfield for Arsenal, which made it very, very difficult for Haaland to find any space. And that's what City have got to overcome, and that's how they get the best out of Erling Haaland, is make space for him.
Yeah, Haaland found out, Sam Roscoe says. You heard it here.
No.
let's finish the first part of the show with a little look at the bigger picture. Richard, it's the first back-to-back defeats for City since the 2018-19 season. That run was actually three defeats in four. So, you know, good luck for the remaining fixtures for this period. Those two defeats, though, were without Fernandinho, as dubbed at the time one of City's most important players. And it suddenly struck me that, like, it just goes to show just how vulnerable City are, whether it's, you know, this incarnation of Guardiola City or any previous incarnation of them. You take that anchor point out and suddenly it becomes a hell of a lot easier to play against City. And the encouragement that I took from from that sort of comparison without Fernandinho is, you know, Gundogan played deeper in those couple of games. And we all went, well, this isn't going to work. And then at the end of that season, Fernandinho was injured, Gundogan played there, and City won every game. It's almost like they need that kick up the backside to go, well, okay, you now need to find a solution if this is the case. And I'm not saying for one second that if Rodri gets injured for the end of the season, City will be fine. But it's almost like you need that sharp kind of moment to just suggest, actually, we need to think of some ways to deal with this. Do you know what I mean?
Yeah, and I think, like, it is interesting that, like, the similarities in those runs and, you know, losing the players of Fernandinho and Rodri's up. Like, it is an interesting comparison. But I also think, I'm struggling with how I want to phrase this, which, again, is great when I'm here to talk, isn't it? Like, over a season, every single team will face a similar kind of challenge. And it might not be losing a player in the same position as City have done. But, like, over a season, players miss games and teams have to adapt. And I think sometimes, like, it strikes me that comparison could also be, like, a bit false, just because a central defensive midfielder is always going to be a really important position. And
it does depend on how you play, though, doesn't it?
It does. I'm struggling to think of a time in very recent history where that wouldn't be true of most top-level teams, though. They might not always be your best player, but I do think it's a very, very... I think it's quite a specialised position, and I think it is a crucial position. But even so, most teams at some point have to play a game without their best player. Like, even if that's just on a pure rotation basis. And part of how you get through a season is overcoming those challenges. And I don't think you can always... like it's great to say things like you have to have a plan B or you have to be ready for when that happens, but you would never voluntarily put yourself in a position where you're without your most important players.
Yeah, and that's, and so I guess that's the issue as well with the idea of a Rodri backup, because you can't just go out and sign the second best holding midfielder in the world and expect them to sit there and wait for Rodri to not be in the team.
Exactly, and that speaks.
That's why we've got Calvin Phillips, isn't it? Isn't he the second greatest defensive midfielder in the world? And then all of a sudden, now he's not.
That's your quote, not mine.
We will literally never know because we never see any evidence of how he can play football. Ultimately, you're never going to deprive yourself of your best player voluntarily. Certainly not for a game of like the magnitude that we've just played, and so. The idea of like having a plan B, like you're always working stuff out sort of on the fly in these kind of situations. And we just so happen to have a manager who is one of the best in the world, if not the best in the world at doing that. And so, I don't know. I've done my thing of almost forgetting your question.
It's all right. It's hard after a defeat, though, isn't it? Because you can't look at it in the framework of anything but, oh, we've just been beaten in this way. And ultimately, you know, Guardiola's plan for the Arsenal game, if the ball doesn't smash off Nathan Ake's face, we come away from it saying it's been a good result. So
exactly. Nobody comes away thinking, like, after if they draw that game 0-0, nobody comes away thinking he should have done something different in defensive midfield, do they?
Yeah.
Thank you for succinctly, as ever, David, succinctly rounding up my point.
It's okay. Sam, final question for the first part of the show. Given that City are now in this position of having lost back-to-back games, they're not necessarily under pressure, but I then look at the fixture list, and my word, Brighton at home, Young Boys away, United away, Bournemouth at home, Young Boys at home, Chelsea away, and then an international break, then Liverpool at home, Leipzig at home, Spurs at home, and Villa away. What do you reckon?
I'm going to give you a big quote that you can use everywhere now.
All right.
But the next, that run of fixtures that you say, season defining. Absolutely season defining. They have to bounce back because that's what they need to do. Obviously, three Premier League defeats. They have to bounce back. I don't think the international break has come at a great time. But
on the contrary, I think it's come at a brilliant time, you know.
No, I disagree. I think
let them stew on it. Let them stew on it for the fortnight, and then come back raring to
fair,
go.
Fair. I think the players will just wanted to get back into the next game as soon as possible, and get back into that winning groove. They've got some massive games coming up. It's season defining in the sense that if things continue the way they've been going, which is dreadful, then. It's not going to be great for the season as a whole. However, if they go on a run and put several wins together, it's going to be, the confidence is going to be flowing, and we're going to see the return of the City juggernaut in some huge games, starting with Brighton at home, which is a real sobering match after three Premier League defeats and an international break to get back into the swing of things.
Yeah. So, credit to you. If you're still with us through all the depressing Arsenal talk, then credit to you, because we're now going to finish the show with some fun. So, away from England over the weekend, you might have seen that AC Milan went top of Serie A in Italy with a 1-0 win over Genoa. But the story of that game was that they finished with striker Olivier Giroud in goal. In our usual way of making this all about City, that's the tenuous link we've got for making Sam here look at some of the times when City goalkeepers weren't where you'd expect them to be.
Everyone loves an outfield player going in goal, and there have been a number of them down the years for Manchester City. Defender Mike Doyle once had to deputise for Keith McRae at Leicester after the goalkeeper was injured inside 10 minutes in 1975. Meanwhile, Nigel Gleghorn swapped with Andy Dibble twice, first after injury at Walsall in 1989, and then again at home to Crystal Palace a couple of months later. All three of those games happened when teams were allowed to name one substitute, but it was never a goalkeeper that was on the bench. Back in 1964, though, there were no subs at all.
One of the most famous stories is Harry Dowd, one of the City goalkeepers in the 60s. City were playing against Bury. It was actually Colin Bell's debut for Bury, and he scored to put Bury in front.
And then later in the game, Harry Dowd, the City goalkeeper, broke his thumb, I think it was, and ended up, like, at the time there's no substitute, so he ended up having to play outfield, and the forward Matt Gray went in goal to replace him.
That's the podcast's David Mooney, speaking with the help of research by Gary James. He explains what happened next.
Harry Dowd went on to score City's equaliser in the game. He said afterwards that he got the chance to try and slip a ball through to Derek Kevin. He hit the bar, and Dowd just described it as going lunging in to try and get to the ball first, and he managed to score the equaliser.
Perhaps the most famous outfielder in goal moment for City, though, happened in 1991. Goalkeeper Tony Colton was sent off, giving away a penalty, and Niall Quinn put the gloves on instead.
I played in goal from 9 to 12 for the under 12s up to under 14s at Manortown. And I played Gaelic football as well, so I could catch the ball. I was a midfielder in Gaelic football. And when I went over to England as a striker, I used to always look at the goalkeepers and go, I should have stuck at goalkeeper. They don't do any of the running. When we do all the running up the hills in those days and up the terraces, the goalkeepers are doing diving and they're doing crossing and they're doing all these different things. They didn't have to run. I was going, and they're playing till they're 40, you know, and I'm going, my stake with being a goalkeeper. So I always had this bit of a grow for being a goalkeeper.
That's Quinn speaking to broadcaster Doug Gordon's YouTube channel.
I'd scored and Tony Colton got himself sent off. We didn't have a goalkeeper on the bench. And I said, oh, that's it. This is made for me, you know. And as Dean Saunders was putting the ball on the spot to take the penalty, I can remember Adrian Heath saying to him, he'll say this, he does this all the time. Because I used to practice penalties in goal as a goalkeeper. Mm. So I used to try and make a few quid. I'd offer players, score three against me out of three, or a fiver. And I won more often than not, because someone on the third one would get wobbly and put it over the bar, or, you know, it did it with the Irish team more so than the Man City team.
Quinn did save the penalty, and City won 2-1, with the stand-in goalkeeper looking comfortable between the sticks.
What I'm more proud of, and it's not on YouTube, and I'd love to know if it was out there, was I came for the cross and knocked over Mick Harford and Mark Wright, who was, you know, Mark Wright, big centre half, and I knocked the two of them over and caught them. I got into the moment and I started spizzing the ball out with spin on it when I was thrown. I was going, this is great. And afterwards, I thought about it and thought, geez, that was my mentality was never to get nervous about that. I think I couldn't do it. I was born to do this. And then there are times when you think afterwards, geez, did I get away with that? Like, you know, how did that work?
But as the Premier League era began, outfielders in goal became less frequent. Teams were soon able to name three, then five, then seven, and now nine subs, with City often having two goalkeepers in reserve. It now takes a specific set of circumstances, like when Edison went off injured, and then Claudio Bravo was sent off at Atalanta in 2019. Kyle Walker went in goal for the closing stages that night and spoke to BT Sport about it afterwards.
I try and sometimes back to the keepers in training, telling them to catch it and stuff, but as I found tonight, sometimes you do have to take two touches.
You made one very important save.
Yeah, I mean, listen, it's all jokes aside, we came here to get, you know, a point or a victory. We know it was going to be difficult because they play man-to-man, they're a good team and they're in the Champions League for a reason. So it's come away from here with, you know, how we ended the game with a draw is a good point, and, you know, we'll take that on now.
Very, very occasionally, the opposite happens too. We heard earlier about Harry Dowd's exploits outfield. There have been a couple other examples more recently. There was the League Cup tie in 1995, when Martin Margetson replaced Richard Edgehill outfield for a final few minutes after Alan Ball had used his other two subs. It wasn't a very notable occasion. However, the next one goes down in City folklore.
Chappie at half-time went to me, got your kit printed. I'm like, what do you mean? And he went, you know, you might be going up front, or going on outfield. And I was like, whatever, and dismissed it straight away.
That's David James. He started in goal against Middlesbrough on the final day in 2005, but that's not where he finished. City needed to win to leapfrog Borough in the UEFA Cup places, and chasing a goal, manager Stuart Pearce made a unique tactical move. James, alongside substitute goalkeeper Nicky Weaver, explains what happened.
Sat on the bench, Tim Flowers went, about 10 minutes left, went, go and get warmed up. You're going on in a minute, and I'm, Weaves, you! I'm thinking he can't just be putting me on for like 5 minutes to say, like, you know, thanks for coming sort of thing.
The board goes up. I hadn't even seen Nicky getting warmed up. I was so in the game that I hadn't seen him getting warmed up. And when I looked over and I saw him stood there, I was thinking, hang on a minute.
And then I saw the kit man, Chappy, pull out an outfield shirt with number one James on it. So I'm thinking,
and I sort of ran towards it, and then I could see my shirt. That's why, obviously, I derobed and put the outfield shirt on.
Claudio Reyna had come off, and I have gone on. So it was weird, because James ran over. So everyone looked like he was coming off. It wasn't just for, like, 2 minutes. It was probably, by the time injury time was, it was probably the best part of 10 minutes.
I literally had no one telling me what to do, so I thought I'll just sort of go up there and try and win headers.
J-Mo was terrible, wasn't he? But he caused a bit of havoc and we got the penalty, didn't we?
Surreal is probably an understatement because, as I say, I wasn't an outfield player. I mean, I could score goals in training, granted, but had the manager at some point said, J-Mo, you might be going up front tomorrow, I would have done a little bit of practice. I reckon I would have stayed out for an extra hour working on my touch, working on my passing, working on all the things that let me down on the day.
City didn't get the goal they needed and it finished 1-1. Meaning Middlesbrough qualified for Europe. Looking back, some might say that's a good thing in hindsight. Otherwise, we might be sitting here today discussing what a tactical masterstroke it was for Pearce to send his goalkeeper up front.
Hi, I'm David James, and you're listening to the Blue Moon Podcast.
This is the Blue Moon Podcast. But don't worry, it'll be over soon.
That was Sam taking a look at the times when City goalkeepers have been not in their usual place. Sam, the David James story is obviously the maddest one. Do you reckon we'll see anything like that again? Ortega in goal, Edison outfield, you know?
I think the real question is, and the obvious answer to that real question is, do we want to see it happen again?
I mean,
and the answer is absolutely yes.
Yes.
Who wouldn't love to see Edison play up front?
Guardiola won't even let him take penalties, though. He's such a spoil sport.
Yeah, I mean, the frustrating thing is Alisson scored, didn't he, not too long ago for Liverpool, which was a pretty big goal for them. We need to see this happen with Edison. Make it happen, Pep.
Yeah, Edison could probably do it, though, just by punting the ball the length of the pitch. So I honestly think he should shoot more often. Richard, what do you remember about the moment you realised that David James was coming outfield?
Well, like, first of all, being wrapped up in the return of Nicky Weaver, like, that was, it was a surprise to see a change of goalkeeper. But I remember seeing, from my recollection, I would have seen Weaver coming on. And then there's the moment of, it's not David James that's going off. And just being utterly confused.
This? Yeah.
Until you see that James has put on the outfield shirt, and then, like, that dawning realization of this is a tactic. Like, and I think probably, like, do have the sense that you're seeing something like almost historical. Like, it's not something that happens very often. It's unique in Premier League terms, I think. So, yeah, I think just the surprise of it all, and then there is the, like, the excitement of, God, what if he scores? Like, if this works, then this is going to be...
It was never going to work, was it?
but James was a... James being in there is a big part of why City won a penalty, though, wasn't it? If Fowler had...
You could
scored,
put anybody at the back post there and they'd have won a penalty.
I think there's a lot to be said for the chaos of James being up there that contributes to that. If Fowler had scored that penalty, we would look back on it as a successful substitution.
I don't know.
Bold.
Yeah.
I thought I was the one doing bold claims on the show today.
Yeah, I know.
Well, you're the one who called Haaland a fraud and said he's finished.
Sam, just quickly, we say for the Kyle Walker one where he went in goal against Atalanta, we say that Walker kept a clean sheet. Can we honestly say that? He played, what, 8 minutes? Like, how long do you have to play to say that you've kept a clean sheet? And is that time less when you are an outfield player?
I think in Kyle Walker's case, 8 minutes is enough to say he kept a clean sheet, to be honest. Yeah, I mean, look, I'd imagine the opposition were like, right, shoot on sight. So that's, yeah, he kept a clean sheet for me.
Can I propose a formula?
Yeah.
A very simple one. Am I right in thinking that Bravo played 4 minutes?
No, he conceded after 4 minutes. So Edison played 45 and didn't concede. Bravo played until the 81st minute when he was sent off, but conceded after 4 minutes of coming on the pitch.
Right, but the formula still works. If you play more minutes than it took a supposed goalkeeper to concede a goal, if you play more minutes and keep a clean sheet, then, I mean, double the minutes. Bravo conceded a goal in half the time it took Walker to keep a clean sheet, then that counts as a clean sheet, surely.
Fine. Okay, we'll go with that. I look forward to seeing it. We never see it that often because City normally have two keepers on the bench, but I look forward to putting your formula into action the next time we get a chance. It's been announced this week that the UK and Ireland will be hosting Euro 2028 and that the Etihad will be one of the venues used for the tournament as well. That also got us thinking about previous international matches that have been held there. Having done a little bit of research, we've been able to find six. Here they are. The first international games at the Etihad were held less than a year after City had moved there. The FA hosted a friendly tournament in late May and early June 2004, and all three matches included a City connection. Japan faced two City goalkeepers in those first two games. Arne Arison played for Iceland in their 3-2 defeat in the opening game, while David James played for England in a 1-1 draw 2 days later. Here's the commentary of the Japanese equaliser from TV coverage over there. That game was also the first time that Sven-Goran Eriksson managed in the City of Manchester Stadium's home dugout. It would have been nice if David James had played in the next game, a 6-1 win over Iceland, because that would have meant two City goalkeepers were in opposite ends of an international game played on City's ground. But that wasn't to be. Instead, future City players Frank Lampard, Darius Vassell and Wayne Bridge all scored their first goals at that stadium.
Lampard scores. Bridge! 5-1 to England. Eski. Vassell. That is number 6. Darius Vassell claims his second of the game.
It was far from comfortable in England's next match at the City of Manchester Stadium. This was in the Women's Euros in 2005, where they beat Finland 3-2. Finland came from 2-0 down to equalise in the 88th minute, before Karen Carney scored a stoppage-time winner for the Lionesses. That was in front of more than 29,000 people, which was a record attendance for England women at the time. It's more than a decade until we can find a record of another international match at the Etihad, and it will turn out to be Joe Hart's penultimate appearance at the ground as a home player as England beat Turkey 2-1.
Ismail crosses on a great save by Hart to stop.
What a good save this is. His feet are going one way.
That was in May 2016. Guardiola arrived at City that summer and Hart would make one appearance under the new manager, a 1-0 win at the Etihad over Steaua Bucharest. There were City players involved again when Argentina faced Italy in an international friendly in March 2018. He was having a great season domestically, and Nicolas Otamendi played a big part in helping former City goalkeeper Willy Caballero keep a clean sheet in a 2-0 win for the South American side. That was 5 years ago, and Euro 2028 is still 5 years away, so it'll be interesting to see what City connections could be playing at the Etihad as part of that tournament.
You're listening to the
Blue Moon Podcast.
Blue Moon Podcast.
Podcast. Do you want me to write
it
down?
Podcast.
Podcast, yeah, that's it.
Podcast.
That's the one.
I'm Dennis Law.
Hi, I'm Dennis Law. You're listening to the Blue Moon Podcast.
Okay, all right. I'm Dennis Law, and you're listening to the Blue Man. Hang on, do it again.
Try again.
I'm Dennis Law, and we're listening to the Blue Moon Podcast. Enjoy it.
If you enjoy the show, please give it a rating and a review wherever you get your podcasts.
That was a look at the international matches played at the Etihad. Some obviously some nice tidbits from there about Sven managing in the home dugout first as the England manager. Lampard scoring for England, then Chelsea, then City. Vassell never scored for Aston Villa there, but he scored for England and then City. Weybridge only ever scored there for England. So interesting. I also wanted to mention that the last City manager to make an appearance at Main Road was Roberto Mancini, because he played for Italy's under-21s there in the under-21 Euros in 1984. I was going to do a bigger feature on internationals at Main Road until I realised that the records are very sketchy. So it's really hard to go back and get some firm details. So I made it the stadium that's been open 20 years. Let's finish this week with some listener questions. Get in touch at Blue Moon Podcast. You can also email us as well through the website, bluemoonpodcast.com. I put a call out for things to do on a feature on this week, given that it's the international break. And Mark Simmons suggested that we did something on abandoned matches. And just like the Main Road thing, I was going to until I couldn't find any audio from many of the games. There's a complete record in Gary James's book, Manchester City, The Complete Record. And there are some interesting ones around that. Richard, the one that immediately stands out for me for abandoned games is the League Cup tie with Ipswich in 2000-2001 that was just rained off because of a deluge.
Yeah, I recall it being, I feel like I've said this recently, maybe on a Patreon special. I recall the rain being so bad that when we got to Main Road, my sister took off her shoes and physically emptied them of water, like literally poured them out, like, you know, like you might a mug or something. That was some of the worst weather I ever recall having the misfortune of being outside in, and hate the fact that it was called off shortly after City scored, which I would have been, what, 12? Around 12 at the time, and was fully convinced it was a conspiracy. That
the agenda never sleeps.
No. I don't necessarily believe that now, but at the time I was fully in on George Burley's convinced the referee to call that off. Now we've equalised.
Yeah. Should we hear Nicky Weaver's memories, because he played in that game?
I just remember in the warm up, the rain was coming down, the pitch was getting worse. The referee came out to have a look. You know, it was touch and go, I think, whether the game was actually going to go ahead, but it did. Went 1-0 down quite early on, and then we equalised. And not long after equalising, the game was called off. And to be fair, as a goalkeeper, it's really awkward and horrible position and conditions to play in. So I wasn't too disappointed when it was called off. But we ended up losing the replay anyway, so we would have probably been better off carrying on. But the referee made a decision, and the pitch was pretty much unplayable. I think at that point, the ball was starting to get stuck. It wasn't really bouncing. Players were, you know, trying to dribble with the ball, and the ball was standing still in the wood. So it did become unplayable.
This is the Blue Moon Podcast. Follow us on Twitter at Blue Moon Podcast.
The replay was when Kevin Ollock got kicked in the head and didn't get a penalty, and there was like Terry Butcher-esque blood all down his shirt. The other one that stands out, Sam, is the Manchester Derby in 1974, Dennis Law's back heel goal at Old Trafford caused a pitch invasion in the final few minutes. The referee abandoned the game, but the result was allowed to stand. And the reason why it stands out for me in particular is because you asked him about it, didn't you?
And Dennis has done it.
Yeah.
That was a fun afternoon, you know, getting to speak to one of football's all-time greats. Obviously, a huge, huge presence in Manchester football, not just for his time at Manchester United, but also his time at City, thanks to that moment. He was having absolutely none of it when I asked him about it.
Yeah, I've clipped it up. Here it is.
That week, the build-up to that derby. Just tell me, how were you feeling?
I can't remember it, no. Isn't that strange? Of all the games that I can't remember, that was one. And that week, you realise I'm not answering your question.
Yeah. I don't blame you, to be honest with you.
Check out exclusive City interviews on our website, bluemoonpodcast.com.
There we go. Wouldn't answer that question at all, would he?
No, he's clearly been clearly asked about that a million times, hadn't he?
Yeah. Final one to shout out as well, another one involving Dennis Law. Luton away in 60-61 in the FA Cup. He scored all six in the FA Cup tie at Luton. 21 minutes to go, heavy rain meant the referee abandoned the game with City leading 6-2. It was replayed 4 days later and they lost 3-1. So there we go. Couple of other questions to squeeze in. Guillermo Galapagos on Twitter says, given the reactions to the defeats this week, what's your lowest moment as a City fan? Obviously, I said we were having some fun for this final part, so try and kind of keep the mood up, Richard.
I mean, I don't know how to with that question. easy reference point, only one game I have ever cried at was the defeat at Ipswich that relegated us. In modern times, that would have been in, 2002? 2001,
yeah.
Whatever, relegation from the Premier League when I was 10. Modern times would be the Spurs Champions League defeat for very obvious reasons, the nature of the defeat. However, to put a positive spin on it, going into stoppage time against QPR in 2012 was extremely low. And obviously that all turned out quite well. So lowest point to very quick high, that QPR game would have been the lowest ever, and we rescued it.
And if you to add, Sam, you got any terrible ones?
Well, if Richard would save me any, then I think, yeah, the lowest that I've ever felt during a City game has got to be that QPR moment. Like, just unbelievable pain. But like Richard said, it all worked out quite well in the end. And I think it wouldn't have been the same if it wasn't for that moment. You know, the lowest of the low to the highest of the high, something that only that moment could have given us. Another low moment as a City fan, trying to get a taxi back into Istanbul after the Champions League final win, to be honest, that was pretty low.
Yeah. Finally for this week, Matt Holland on Twitter says, do you have a favourite entrance music for the players walking out at City? I only have one that I like. This song still lives rent-free in my head. And it's one that I always, if you were to ask me to imagine City running out, that's what I hear. So I'll save that in a second. Richard, anything, any particular song that stands out?
We might have the same thing here.
I was going to say, I think we've all got the same, to be honest with you.
I suppose I have two. Like, the two for me are... Did you want to say them, David, seeing as you volunteered?
I don't think ours is the same one, you know.
Really?
Yeah.
Okay. For me, there's equal are Brain Bug and Right Here, Right Now.
Brain Bug was mine, yeah.
Brain Bug was mine as well.
I did initially take this question as what would be your... like ideal entrance music for City. Well, for a long time, my ideal entrance music for City would have been Sending the Clowns, but obviously not very appropriate these days.
I always remember Brain Bug, like Main Road, being a really cold midweek night, dark, under the lights. That's what I always associate with that tune. But then equally, I always remember after the game, they used to play Roll With It. And that's another City association that I have of Main Road and the smell of like hot, you know, smell of chips, the Blue Moon chippy and stuff like that.
Was it not Roll With It when they'd won, but Wonderwall when they lost? I always remember being in Main Road thinking, they've lost again. And it's the opening, like the opening of Wonderwall always takes me back to feeling like that. And I just associate Wonderwall with City having lost, and that's what they played at Main Road. I remember.
I think it was the FA Cup win in 2011, and I think it was primarily because of Zabaleta in the week before was talking about like his music taste, but they played Rocking All Over the World, and that's one that I think is underrated, especially when you've won something.
Yeah, City's won three in a row, Sam.
Exactly. Soon to be four, hopefully.
Yeah. Well, we'll find out later on in the season. But for now, that's it for this week's Blue Moon podcast. Thank you very much for listening. And thanks also to my guests for this one. Sam Roscoe.
Cheers, mate.
And Richard Burns.
Thank you very much.
Join us next week when we'll preview the games with Brighton and Young Boys. And we'll also hear from the former City defender, Steve Howie. See you then.
That was the Blue Moon podcast. Please give the show a rating and a review where you can. And don't forget, you can listen without the ads by signing up to our Patreon. you'll also get an extra episode each Monday. Here's a clip of this week's.
I have told you I've been on the pitch there before, because when I ran on, I playfully smacked Moonchester on the back of the head, because you're running past a 7-foot novelty big blue alien. I just wanted to, I thought it'd be a big foam head. It's actually very hollow. So maybe nowadays with City's increased resources, we've got a better Moonchester costume. But at the time, it was quite sort of hollow Frank Sidebottom kind of vibe to it. But yeah, just a great night. Game.
So was it hard? Because it looked foam to me. So I'm thinking when you hit it, like it would squash in, but did it not?
Precisely. I hit it because I thought it was like hitting a big, like funny cushion. But then of course, it was like hollow. I thought that was going to be a cushion. But then you think about it, as if you're going to put a bloke's head in like a massive sort of 1 meter wide cushion. That's, of course it was hollow, basically. But yeah, it was a night of discovery for me. And what a good day.
You can listen to more of that at patreon.com/Blue Moon Podcast. And join us again next time for another episode.